This is Jane Poulin at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, interviewing John H. Neil Foster. You go by Neil. And Neil, if you wouldn't mind, I just want to make sure you understand the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, that we are a special agency set up by law to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. And today I wanted to talk to you generally about accounting, but I have some specific questions related to FASB Statement 140 that I wanted to get into. Before we go down that path, if you could just, for the record, so that other people who aren't familiar with your background who might listen to this would know what your background is, just give us kind of broad brush, the highlights of your career, maybe mentioning even as far back as where you went to college and kind of what your base degrees might be.
Okay. I have a degree in economics from Colorado College, which is a small liberal arts school in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And subsequent to that, I took some accounting courses at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. I do not have a degree from there, however. I took a job with a small stock brokerage, very small, out of college, and worked there for 2 years and then joined Price Waterhouse. I was there approximately 10 years. And in 81, I left Price Waterhouse and spent a couple of years in the oil and gas business. Again, a small exploration and production company. I then went to Compaq Computer Corporation, where I managed their IPO and subsequent offerings. I was vice president and treasurer, and I spent approximately 10 years there, and then was appointed to the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And I served two terms there, 10 years there. I was there during the deliberations of both Statements 125 and Statement 140. And since that time, I left the board in 2003, and I have done some expert witness and accounting consulting work. And I'm currently on the board of a company called PJM Interconnection, which manages the electricity grid and wholesale electricity markets in 13 states in the District of Columbia. Anything else?
I think that's great.
Okay.
So, Neil, I was doing a little bit of research on accounting for securitizations, and that's addressed in, previously it was addressed in FAS 125 and then in FAS 140. And I had read your dissent in FAS 140, and it prompted me to try to reach out to you to see if I could better understand how you thought about 140 at the time and maybe help me better understand your views that led to your dissent. Before we finish the call, I would, you know, kind of throw the topic open broadly, and we can either do it broadly and then narrow in on FAS 140, or do it in the opposite direction, whichever is comfortable for you. Would be curious to know if what your thoughts are about the role of accounting during the financial crisis. So either ways in which the accounting standards performed well under the stress of the crisis, highlighted, perhaps the stress of the crisis highlighted areas where there were improvements needed in financial accounting. Some folks have argued that there are certain accounting standards that either caused or exacerbated the crisis. So when I talk to folks who are who have views on those areas, I always want to capture any and all views you have across that spectrum.
Okay.
So would you like to go broadly first? Or
yeah, when, why don't we do?
Okay.
Well, as we spoke last week, my dissent was over a couple of pretty narrow issues. I generally believe that the Statement 125, Statement 140 model, what we call the financial components approach, is a good model. It wasn't perfect. As I said in the dissent, for example, I would have measured everything that you have left after a securitization at fair value, and neither of those standards did that. But I think the idea, the notion was, is you started out with an asset, you sliced and diced it, you may have taken on other obligations as well as slicing up the asset and into different rights and obligations. And I actually, obviously in the financial crisis, there were some problems with the way securitizations were done, but I am kind of I'm a supporter of the notion, and I believe that it used to be argued by our constituents that the sum of the parts could be greater than the whole, and I think there's evidence that that's true. If you define certain risks that people want and you give them those risks and you take away risks that they don't want, I think there's value in that process. My dissent was really over the notion of, I think that we got a little bit schizophrenic when we were doing Statement 125 and Statement 140, and then we exacerbated it with Statement 140.
Is this with regards to the QSPEs?
Well, not really. The QSPEs is an element of that. The QSPE issue was, to be honest with you, I don't think we had a full understanding of when we put the QSPE into Statement 125. The notion was that QSPEs were brain dead, that all of the things that it could do and the way that it was going to distribute the cash flows and collect the cash flows were set up in the documents that established it. And then the cash just got collected and it ran off. And eventually, all of the assets transferred to the SPE were collected or liquidated it didn't really have any operating activities. And then we subsequently found out that in fact they do. And we made through EITF issues and interpretations, there were allowances for example, services to work out loans, which clearly isn't a brain-dead activity. In my mind, at that point, we should have pulled the plug on QSPs. But
so does that... you guys didn't realize that there was going to be a need for services for working out loans at the time 125 and 140 were issued. But then,
it's more like we found out that servicers could modify loans and do workout stuff, which involves a lot of decision making. Mm-hmm. It isn't just this notion that you put a bunch of assets there and they run off and you don't have to worry about them anymore.
Okay, so then the idea that the QSPE was brain dead, didn't have any decision making, came to your attention that perhaps they have more decision making than you thought.
Right. In fact, we were told that and we started drawing lines of what they could do and what they couldn't do. Statement 140, let me go back and give you, again, a little history. The board's rationale for QSPEs was that... let me go back a little further. I'm sure I'm telling you stuff you already know, but I'll do it anyway. the rationale underlying the financial components approach was if you have an asset and you transfer that asset to somebody else, there's often a question, are you really giving them collateral for a borrowing or are you selling the asset? And a lot of times, you can't tell. There's characteristics of both. So what we decided is that if in the event of a bankruptcy, Well, what we really decided is if the transferee, the guy who gets the asset, can do anything he want with it, and the transferor can't get it back, even in the event of bankruptcy, that the asset was sold. And the notion on QSPEs was extended. They said, well, the transferee, which in that case is the QSPE, can't really do anything they want with these assets. But if the beneficial interest holders in the QSPE can sell their assets and do whatever they want with their assets, that because they have undivided interest in the transferred assets, that's sufficient to meet the criteria. And when the assets can be changed or additional assets come into the QSPE, it calls into my mind, at least, a lot of questions about whether, in fact, you do have undivided interest in the assets in the SPE. But I'm giving you more of my views than I am the board's views.
Right.
At the end of the day, the board concluded that, yeah, we'll let you do limited things and still have a QSPE. Any other questions about QSPEs? Or?
So the conflict that you saw was this conflict that the original idea was under financial components that the transferee, that would have been the QSPE in this case, the entity, can sell, pledge, do whatever it wants with its assets, and the transferor, who in many cases...
But see, it couldn't.
Right, I understand.
It couldn't do that.
Right, so a regular SPE, that would be the rule.
Right.
But for a QSPE, because, I don't know what the constructs were, but I guess it's because these were set up for mortgage securitizations. Why, do you know why it is that the SPE wouldn't have had the right to transfer the assets that go into the Q?
It's not an accounting issue. It's essentially a legal issue. The way they were set up is, again, they were set up, so we put these assets, let's do a CMO. They're set up, let's put these assets in there and just let them run off.
The idea was that these are not managed.
Right.
They are created by contract.
Well, not just that, but there were restrictions in the governing documents of the QSPE that said they couldn't sell them.
Right.
And said they couldn't pledge them. They just have to collect the money and let them run off.
Okay.
So that's where that restriction comes from.
Right.
It's just part of the way they, part of the business deal. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Just trying to get at whether this is an inherently problematic setup to have the rules be that the transferee has to be able to sell or pledge the assets and the transferor can't access those even in a bankruptcy. That equals a sale. Most people would say, yeah, that seems to make sense. But then we've created this separate rule that seems quite different from the base rule for entities that are supposed to be brain dead, but then we ultimately determine they're really not brain dead, but we don't change the rule to say, okay, because they're not brain dead, the special rule doesn't apply anymore. And I can understand why we wouldn't want to do that, but it seems as though over time there were points in time where it was clear that the QSPE structure wasn't working as intended. And it should.
And the FASB didn't do anything about it.
Well, in my mind, there are a number of players here that should have said, well, gee, this doesn't seem to fit the base model under FAS 140. And why does it make sense to have transactions that are similar accounted for differently? So if it's done in a QSPE, it's going to get one kind of treatment. If it's done outside of a QSPE with the same constructs, the same economics, it's going to get different accounting. That just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Well, it doesn't, and I agree with you, but that's...
So one of the things I've heard is that, and I think I there are words in either the basis or something. See here. It may be in the basis that the FASB seemed to believe in the drafting of 140 that regular securitizations should be afforded off balance sheet treatment. And I think if we're talking about something that truly is brain dead and was, and I've said this to other people and they say, no, you're thinking about this differently. You're thinking risk and rewards. This isn't a risk and rewards model. This is a control model. But to me, if we're talking about a securitization that included 30-year fixed-rate mortgages to mortgagees with 700 FICO scores, people would probably be able to understand that those could be the kind of securitizations you talk about, which were what the FASB thought QSBs were originally, is that they would just run off. I guess I add to that that there would have been 20% down, right? So if they're 30-year fixed, 20% real down payment, 700 FICO scores, then those seem like those would probably run off. But the model under 140 wasn't based on any kind of risk analysis. It was really a control model, and we built into that control model this special structured QSPE.
Well, the reason for building it in, as opposed to the rationale.
Right.
Again, the rationale was, well, if it's truly brain dead and if the beneficial interest holders can sell and pledge and do anything they want with their beneficial interest, then that's good enough because they really have an undivided interest in the assets. That was the rationale.
Right, and their regular securitizations are going to run off.
And as we've discussed, maybe that rationale wasn't so good.
Yeah.
But the real reason for creating the QSPE is we didn't have a robust consolidation standard. We always said that consolidation is based on control, but actually it was partially the SEC's fault in my view, but basically there was a bright line 50%. You have 50%, you consolidate, or 50%+ you consolidate. If you have less than 50%, you don't. Which isn't, in my view, the control model, and we didn't have a robust control model. And there was a fear that even if you complied with all the requirements of Statement 125, which is where it was created, you'd end up saying, well, the transferor controls that QSBE or SBE, consolidated.
Right, because it doesn't
own
50% of the voting.
We don't want to have that conflict. And that was why it got created in the first place.
I understand. So, because I'm thinking in at least the FIN 46R world where...
this is before that.
Yeah, that if QSPEs, post-46R, if QSPEs had been scoped out of FIN 46... They
right.
might have gotten consolidated under FIN 46, and then there might have also not been a need for QSPEs.
Exactly.
If you bought into that consolidation model. So, but let me pick up on one comment you made. But we didn't have a robust consolidation standard at the time of FAS 140, and that's partially the SEC's fault.
I probably shouldn't have said that.
I thought you might.
The SEC basically interpreted the control model,
right?
Not always consistently, but generally, that again, 50% was a bright line. If you were below that, you didn't have to consolidate. If you were above that, you did.
I got you.
Now they didn't always do that, and I shouldn't blame it on the SEC. That was practice too.
Yeah.
But I think the SEC accepted it.
Gotcha.
And when there's anecdotal evidence that when an issue came to the commission, that was how it was applied.
Right.
Not always, but most of the time.
Yeah, the SEC and even the Office of the Chief Accountant has been a little bit schizophrenic over the years. If you look back, whether they defer to the FASB or they don't defer to the FASB, I think prevailing view is now they defer to the FASB. So. So whatever the rules are that you write.
I don't think they overrode it. We didn't. Yeah. It was all just as much our fault.
Yeah.
Consolidations, when I got there in 1993, consolidations had been on the agenda for 10 years, and it was still on the agenda when I left.
Yeah.
We weren't able to. It was our fault. I mean, I shouldn't have made that a side comment.
No, I just wanted
to.
I thought you might be picking up on
the
3% thing, the Enron problem. But,
well, actually, the 3% thing, since we're talking about it.
I thought that was a D topic.
I'm sorry?
I thought that was a D topic.
It was.
Yeah.
The 3% thing, again, was I don't know how much you've studied it, but I actually think it was a pretty good standard. You know, people throw stones at Enron. Well, the fact of the matter is, most of the frauds at Enron were because they couldn't get somebody to put up 3%.
Right.
I guarantee it.
Yeah, no, I understand. Most of Enron's consolidation problems were they didn't even comply with the 3% rule. But
right.
The 3% rule gets tainted because of Enron. Yeah.
Right. But it actually, I think it was a pretty good rule. And it also wasn't applied as you intended. What happened is in 9015, and the EITF issue 9015, somebody from the commission, which dealt with leasing SPEs, which are pretty solid. You know, there's a building, there's, you know, they said, yeah, 3% is probably a good number.
Uh-huh.
And so then all of a sudden it got applied to all kinds of really risky stuff.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't think the commission or whoever put that in 9015 ever intended. So that's kind of the problem with that.
Okay.
Anyway.
So do you...
Anyway, the point is that we didn't have a robust consolidation standard. There was concern, well, you comply with everything in 125 and then you have to consolidate it anyway, so it negates the transaction. And that's why we created the QSP.
Or, well, if there wasn't a robust consolidation standard, the sponsors wouldn't have owned over 50% of the voting shares, would they, or would they? Or they would.
Well, they didn't, but you could argue that they set the thing up.
Uh-huh.
They put in all the documents, and you had people that argued, well, no, they had to negotiate with the underwriter to get something that they could sell, so they didn't get to do exactly what they wanted to, but you could argue that the sponsor basically was in control and should consolidate. And we didn't have anything that you could point to say that, no, that's a wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know whether that was a wrong answer.
Right. Yeah, no, when I got to the staff, consolidations had been on the agenda for a long, long time. It was, by the time FIN 46 was issued, it was something like 25 years or something, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, it's a really long time. I mean, it's hard work the FASB does. These aren't exactly easy questions to answer. And I'm sure at some point in time somebody's going to look back on 166 and 167 and say, what about this?
I'm sure they will.
So,
it was a difficult issue. And again, in general, I think it was a pretty good model.
Yeah. Do you remember, I guess I can backtrack to the EITFs, but approximately what year was it that the FASB became aware that the QSPEs had decision-making beyond what you had originally thought?
It was almost immediately after it was issued. Almost.
Oh, was it related to the commercial?
It was
commercial?
Within a year, because what happened is the people that were doing these transactions came back to us and said, wait a minute, you made this way too tight. We can't function under the way you've written it. And then we started making, and I can't remember all the specific stuff, but I do remember, we started saying, well, you can do this, and that's okay. That won't taint it. But
because there was it was
pretty quick.
Yeah, there was a very late comment letter, like, this standard was effective for securitizations after March 31. And you got a comment letter from the American Securitization Forum dated, like, March 10th. raising concern about commercial mortgage securitizations, which seemed those, I mean, to me, those seem like they would potentially have even more decision-making potential, but arguably it's the same types of things you'd have in a residential mortgage securitization.
Right. Well, and again, keep in mind, we weren't focused just on your basic CMOs or CDOs. There were also these credit card receivables and revolving kinds of things that we had to consider when we were put this thing together as well.
Right. Student loans, credit cards.
Right.
Okay. And prior to 125, was practice mixed? In some cases, these things were accounted for as financings? Because I know there's some predecessor old literature.
I don't recall.
Jay, yeah, I'll have to backtrack a little bit.
Yeah, you could. I'm sure you still have friends at the SEC. I'm sure they would have a better handle on that than I do.
Yeah. So the but certainly these standards grew out of practice, the types of arrangements that companies were getting involved with.
Yeah, it was a relatively new kind of a structure.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we got 125 issued, they've been around for 5 or 6 years, and I don't know what the accounting was before that.
Right. Okay. So then, more broadly, unless you had other points on 140, I think I...
Nope.
Understand that. So more broadly, what are your views on the role of accounting during the financial crisis?
Well, as I said, I actually think that I would have tweaked it, of course, but the idea that you account for, I mean, the idea was that gave rise to the financial components approach was that you had a receivable and you transferred that receivable into an SPE or whatever vehicle, and you got back cash. But generally, I mean, we were told generally you had to keep what we call the toxic waste. There were also other obligations, you had servicing assets, and you had usually some other obligations associated with it. And the idea was, you don't have those original receivables anymore. You have other things.
Right.
And you ought to account for those. And, again, I think that's... I think we've actually had kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and I think we're going to... And I descended to FIN 46 as well, because I think that it's not as good a model as the 9015 model was.
Mm.
And I think that it's going to cause, again, it was schizophrenic, and I think that it's going to end up with a lot of things being consolidated by somebody that doesn't control them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's possible under the original, I haven't kept up with all the revisions, to be honest with you, but under the original FIN 46, it was possible that two people would consolidate the same SPE.
Right, yeah.
That's clearly wrong. I mean, that's just not right, in my view. So, I also believe that, you know, a lot of people have asserted that if you didn't have to mark these things to market, the crisis would have gone away and that kind of stuff. And in case you don't know, I'm a big proponent of fair value, so I'm not buying into that argument at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's like burying your head in the sand. Well, let's pretend it's not what it is. If, you know, and my view is if the banking regulators want to increase the capital temporarily during a crisis, or decrease the capital requirements temporarily during a crisis, or make some other adjustment to the capital requirements, that's up to them. But just pretending that it's not there doesn't seem to be the right answer to me.
Right. So this is a good point. So the linkage between GAAP and regulatory accounting has been there since, I think it's FIDICIA, which came through after the S&L crisis.
Right.
And one of the things I would be curious to get your opinion on is, because the FASB writes GAAP, and it's linked to the bank regulatory accounting. Does that, I mean, obviously that creates some sort of conflict with the FASB is trying to serve more than one master, whereas we want investors in the SEC, which is, you know, protecting investors, wants to make sure that financial reporting is transparent. And banking regulators sometimes have alternative views. They're about safety and soundness. So do you think that the FASB's mission should be reconsidered? I mean...
No, I would decouple the...
Decouple, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if the regulators... They used to have regulatory accounting. The biggest dispute that I can recall that you might be aware of is there was a big dispute between the SEC and... I don't know whether it was OTS or all of those guys together.
About loan loss.
Over how you account for loan... Yeah. Loss reserves. It's clear that GAAP says that you don't anticipate losses. Well, those guys thought you should, and they went in and actually would sanction people for not having a big enough loan loss reserve when they were actually complying with GAAP.
Yeah, that's funny.
That what I would do is, I think you're absolutely right. They're fundamental different purposes, and I think that I certainly wouldn't change the FASB's mission.
Uh-huh. Well, if it became something more along the lines of, financial transparency for investors, then it would become clear that that GAAP was being written for that purpose. I'm not sure if there's an appetite out there for decoupling, but I'm sure that that's something that's on the radar for bank regulators.
Well, I think that's what I meant, basically having the regulators say, yeah, look, you know, do GAAP, but do this instead of GAAP for our purposes, for purposes of calculating capital. And I mean, you know that broker-dealers, for example, do that. They've got special rules.
Right.
You could do the same thing for banks and other financial institutions, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the mission of the FASB is pretty clear, that GAAP is supposed to result in useful information for investors and creditors.
Right.
And I certainly wouldn't change that.
Okay. Say that again?
For what it's worth.
Yeah. Any other areas that you had comments on?
Well, like I said, I think that this... One other thing is, as I told you, I'm a big proponent of fair value. I think that a lot of what happened is the result of people not being, a lot of things, even though I'm a proponent of fair value, I think that there was a lot of what they call mark to model, obviously, and it turned out the models didn't sufficiently contemplate liquidity risk. So I think that was a big contributor to what happened.
And right.
It was pervasive, with the possible exception of Goldman, who's, I guess, the bad guy these days. Everybody else's models were wrong.
Yeah.
Which is troublesome.
I know the vision of lemmings going off the edge comes to mind. I don't have great visibility into the specifics of any individual models. I'm a pretty detail-oriented person. I like to have some real, actual, data. Certainly liquidity risk. It seems as though at some point in time it becomes more than liquidity. It almost acts like it's credit risk.
Well, it kind of is. They're certainly interrelated. I told you I was on AIGFB's board, and we were told long before this happened that major banks such as well, I won't name any names, but major banks basically closed up shop. I mean, they just weren't doing any transactions because they didn't, I mean, it was credit risk that caused them to do that. But it exacerbated the liquidity risk because when everybody closes up shop, there's no liquidity.
Right.
So you're clearly right. They're interrelated. But.
Yeah, well, there's also the mark-to-market. I'm, you know, not necessarily opposed to mark-to-market accounting, but there is a mark-to-market play here. If you think about, so if a company's, why is a company closing up shop, right? So they're closing up credit, and is it because there is pressure on, there's pressures in the market, and there's indicators in the market that the things they're already exposed to are declining in value, which is going to lead to them to have to de-lever,
right,
to satisfy either their capital requirements or expectations of what their capital and leverage ratio leverage will look like when they report every 90 days. So there is kind of that hanging out there.
Yeah, it's a down self-fulfilling downhill spiral.
Yeah, yes, there is some of that. I don't think mark-to-market accounting has much of an impact when we're trading today, right? And there's no liquidity in the market, and in order to liquidate what I have to take a significant haircut. But those transactions lead to, every 90 days, I have to measure what my capital is.
Right, but I don't think you can blame the accounting.
No, I don't blame the accounting. And then sometimes I wonder, well, geez, if I'm the CFO of big bank, right, and water's coming in over the edge, right? I'm in the boat, water's coming in over the edge. What are the first three things I think of, and is one of them regulatory capital? I don't know if it is. I think I'm more concerned with, you know, living to die another day, and I'll deal with the wrath of my regulator when and if that day comes. I'm just not sure what the mindset is, you know, because that's measured every 90 days, and there's a delay in when that information is reported. So it seems to me like the daily trades, balancing my book and satisfying my daily liquidity needs, are going to be on my top three things I'm concerned about as I'm running the business. Or whatever piece of the business you'd be in charge of. If you're not the CEO of big bank, you're running a portfolio, right?
Yeah, no, that's what you say makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what goes through their or went through their minds, but it's hard to argue with what you said.
Yeah, but I think people blame fair value accounting because the trades that are occurring lead to marks at a point in time when the filing has to be done. So. And that may lead to them having to delever more because if it's the 30th day of the, or the 90th day of the quarter, the market may be such that I may have so many level two and particularly level three assets on my books that it's difficult for me to project even on that 90th day where my balance sheet's going to end up.
Well, no, I see your point, but Is it right just to pretend that the market's something else, or these assets are worth something different?
No, I don't think. I think that could have caused even more irrational behavior in the marketplace because of the lack of transparency.
Yeah. Right, and it just introduces uncertainty, and we all know that's a bad thing.
Right. So, but I do see there's a connection, but I don't know how to fix it because I'm like you think that. Transparency of assets that are, you know, held for trading, that we're required to be carried at fair value should present the most current information that we have available. Anyway, any other thoughts? Have you looked at the proposed standard on financial instruments?
I haven't.
Okay.
I know there's a split between the FASB and the IASB.
Right, yeah, so that's problematic.
So we'll see how that shakes out.
There's a, well, yeah, it would be interesting reading for you to pull up the comment letters to date that the FASB has received, because there's an expansion of fair value accounting.
Right, right. No, I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
I'm just not intimately familiar with it.
But a lot of it's going through OCI, so...
Yeah, most of it.
Yeah, right, but then they're changing to the comprehensive income statement, so it'll be interesting to see how the market, assuming these standards went through as written, it'd be interesting to see how the market responds to the second attempt for comprehensive income statement.
We shall see.
We'll see if people are still focused on net income. All right, well, Neil, I'm going to hang on just a minute if you didn't have anything else. Any non-accounting points you think I should be aware of in dealing with identifying causes of the financial crisis?
No, I think we pretty well covered it.
Okay.
If you have other questions, that you follow-up questions, feel free to give me a call.
Okay.
And you got a tough job. Good luck.
Okay. Well, hang on. I'm just going to set the recorder off, and then I want you to say 1 minute of
All right.
Points.